Welcome to the Remarkable Retail Podcast, Season 11, Episode 12. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Steve Dennis.
Our guest on this episode is Julie Bornstein, founder CEO of Daydream, a new kind of experience, one that's powered by AI but grounded in human taste, a chat-based shopping agent. Julie is an accomplished retailer and retail technologist with stints at Nordstrom, Urban Outfitters, Sephora, Stitch Fix. She started the Yes, and then it was acquired by Pinterest. Daydream is still in beta, so this is something very different for us. We typically don't talk to leaders and companies so young. It's still in beta. She's generous with her time and insights in this nascent AI retail brand. In the news, we'll be covering the final end of the historic U.S. government shutdown, what that means for U.S. retail. U.S. retail numbers that exist, actually, thanks to CNBC and the NRF. Some earnings news from Warby Parker on running, and the surprise departure of Doug McMillon last week. And then right after our interview with Julie, we'll be back to talk about remarkable stories of the week and take a peek around the corner. Steve, you are in rainy London. How's London going?
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. As you point out, the weather is not so great, but I've been here for the better part of a week. And I guess a couple of things just to point out. One is, for people that have been here, they would know it is an amazing shopping city. I spent and have spent a little bit more time wandering about, getting around town, so I saw more of the vibrant shopping areas. But of course, famous places like Regent, New Bond Street, but also some of the newer areas, Battersea Station, the Borough Market, Spitalfields, Covent Gardens, you name it, South Kensington. You go around and you just find a lot of these really vibrant areas, some of them featuring brands that we have featured on the pod, like Birkenstock and Vuori. I think Vuori has three stores now in London, but also fast-growing companies, including one we'll talk about in a little bit, On Running. A couple flagship stores here, I believe. So it is quite wild. And then many iconic retailers, Marks & Spencer, Harrods, Selfridges, Fortnum & Mason, and a store that some of our listeners would know, Liberty. Speaking of Liberty, it's one of my patented segues. I got a chance earlier this week to go with the Shop Talk folks to chat with Adil Mahood Khan, the CEO of Liberty. Now, Liberty is, as Adil describes it, kind of a small department store or a big boutique, because it is not nearly the size of some of the iconic department stores you would think about in the UK or in the US or on the continent for that matter, but it is pretty good size. And it's really kind of a quirky retailer. We shot some footage in the store.
Great.
So we'll be rolling that out over the next couple of weeks so people can get a feel for that, but also sat down with Adil to do a little bit of an interview that is a preview of what we're going to be talking about on stage. So Adil and I, as well as Aesop Chief Customer Officer Suzanne Santos and Shanghai Tongs Chairman Derek Solger, will be part of a panel called Creating Spaces That Welcome, Connect, and Convert. So that will be, a really interesting session. So I got to hear a little bit about what Adil will be talking about. So we'll share a little bit more of those details in the weeks ahead. I will also be on stage a second time, so we'll tease that for now. But just quick reminder before we move into the news, Shop Talk Lux is January 27th through the 29th at the Emirates Palace in Dubai, and we've got a 20% discount on registration for our listeners. That's in the show notes, so check out more about what the conference is all about and then get that discount while it's still available.
All right, let's get right into the news of the week. So finally, the long nightmare is over. The long night is over. After 43 days, the government's going back to work. Talk about its implications. Is it in time to save holiday? Is it have impact on holiday? What make you of this?
Well, it's a little unclear how significant the impact will be, but just to remind people, the federal government has opened, so our long national nightmare is over, sort of, because there are aspects of this that are really just being kicked down the road or uncertain. But what we do know is the shutdown's over after 43 days. Federal workers are back at work and will be getting paid and will be getting back pay. SNAP benefits or food stamps have been restored. And I guess they are essentially guaranteed through next September. Air travel, which has been pretty much a mess for a little bit here, is getting back on track. But the big thing I think that could really impact people's lives, but also impact retail, is the issue that started the shutdown battle, really, is that the healthcare subsidies are not being restored, apparently. There will be a vote that's going to be taken on that, but there's a lot of, I won't get into it for a bunch of reasons. One, it makes me crazy, but also I don't completely understand it, is there's a lot of political jockeying going on. So how this will all sort out across the next several weeks is unclear. We could actually be looking at another shutdown come January because of some of the provisions in the legislation. What this means for retail, I mean, from the perspective of the workers getting their back pay, they should essentially be made whole. But what I would say is that this has injected more uncertainty into the future. Many people, because they've gone without pay for a number of weeks, may have not been able to pay off their credit card balances. So there could be some ripple effects that aren't insignificant to spending. But I would say, for the most part, probably not going to be huge to the holiday spending, because we've still got a fair amount of time and people should have money in their pockets for the final month or so in shopping. But, you know, it's really the lower income folks that are getting hurt the worst. And I saw a recent report that said that 40% of Americans are more or less living paycheck to paycheck. So when something like this happens, it's quite impactful. And as I mentioned, the healthcare subsidies are going to be hitting a lot of people and really squeezing them.
Let's talk about U.S. retail sales. So it's almost in defiance of gravity. I mean, we talk about these things where many people are not getting paid. Now they're getting paid in kind of a lump sum. But boy, retail is just continues to put up some pretty good numbers. Take us through it.
Yeah, really quickly, because it's not a terribly different story than the last several months. Sales were up overall. And by the way, this is the NRF CNBC MasterCard data. Because of the shutdown, there is no census report data. But as I've mentioned before, I think this is probably more accurate anyway. But overall sales year over year were up 5%. Several really strong categories that were above average: clothing and accessories, sporting goods and general merchandise, as well as consumer electronics and appliances. Again, we don't know how much of this is a bit of inflation, presumably some of it. We don't know if there's a little bit of this early Christmas shopping or getting ahead of any tariffs, but that is a slump, somewhat better than average number. But we also see patterns that we have been seeing for a long time. Home furnishings, furniture continue to be down. Home improvement down a very big 8%. Wow. Now, Home Depot, I believe, reports, I think the day this episode is coming out, and then Lowe's usually the day or two after that. So we'll see how that really plays out with the two biggest players in that space. So, it is a little bit hard to understand why we haven't seen a little bit more impact. We'll come back. I mean, I've got a little comment later on that might relate to this, so I'll try to be brief. The other thing, and this is not from the same survey, but one of the organizations that tracks e-commerce sales showed October to be an unusually strong month, up 8.2%. Some of the speculation there is that both because of Prime Day and those responding, and that being a particularly promotional period, that might have driven that number up. But I think we have to really see a longer period of time to try to make sense of whether this is really an acceleration of trend or just a bit of an outlier.
Interesting. So let's kind of keep that kind of thinking about sales rolling. Let's talk about the recent earnings, retail earnings that we've seen. What do you make of them?
Well, we continue to get lots of earnings. And the few that I thought I would just point to really quickly, because I think it speaks more broadly to what's going on in retail and some implications. A lot of these very focused specialty retailers. We'll get Walmart, Target, some of the big super scalers here in the next couple of weeks. So we'll see what that looks like. I think overall, Walmart's going to look really good. Target's going to continue to look poor. But a few that I noticed, On Running, definitely one of our favorite remarkable brands, they just keep rolling along. I think their overall sales are up over 30%, very strong profits. They continue to open a lot of stores. So they're on a very good path. Mm. I think in the spirit of balance, since we talked about a very wobbly unicorn last week, let's talk about a couple of formerly wobbly unicorns that are finding their footing. Mm-hmm. See what I did there? Warby Parker. Now, it's about a year ago that we had their co-founder and co-CEO, Neil Blumenthal, on the podcast. Their sales were up over 15%, so that's quite a bit above the industry average. Of course, some of that is new store openings. They opened 15 new units in the quarter. That got them over 300 stores, I believe, to 315. But they're also expanding their profitability. Their EBITDA margin is now up to 11%. So that's pretty healthy for a company that continues to invest. And then the Real, kind of famously, I think I talked about them, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, as one of these digitally native brands that really was not performing well and the stock had really collapsed. Well, the stock has been, I don't even want to say creeping up, has been on a nice rise for the better part of a year. So they are nicely back into true unicorn. I think they're about, market cap's about $1.7 billion or something like that. Yeah. But their sales up 17%. And then the last one, which is very much not a small focused company, but speaks more to what's going on in e-commerce, Shopify, good Canadian company. I just thought I'd beat you to the punch by putting that out there.
Thank you.
Revenues up nearly 32%. Now, as I suppose most folks will know, Shopify powers a lot of e-commerce. They also have more of a broader point of sale system now. So it's not, you can't look at that and just say that is e-commerce growth for certain kind of merchants. But the e-commerce part of it is a very big part of their business. So you look at that number and say they are greatly outperforming just about everybody else that is primarily in the e-commerce space. So and nicely profitable as well. So there's definitely some really strong pockets of success amidst whatever general to-ing and fro-ing and turmoil we see.
So there's lots of news and lots of headlines being put out that this is the first true AI shopping holiday event. And now we're seeing some numbers that are validating this this enthusiasm. Talk about what you saw from Adobe Analytics.
I think it was just 2 or 3 weeks ago, we talked about the very large increase in AI-driven traffic, but it was not converting especially well. It was converting less than typical search traffic. Mm-hmm. Well, Adobe Analytics has a new study that shows a dramatic turnaround from just a few months earlier that indicates that AI-powered shopping traffic is converting 16% better than traditional channels. So I remember when we first did the story, I said, you know, it may just be that people are kind of exploring, they're not so serious, so that would explain the conversion, but also at the same time, there's learning going on that will improve it. Well, if you believe the Adobe research, and they generally know what they're talking about, we're seeing better conversion. So I would imagine retailers looking at that would say, maybe we need to get behind this more strongly if we're not already doing it. And then another big story, which we really don't have time to get into, and I imagine we'll come back, and we're just seeing this kind of frenzy pace of announcements just about every week from retailers and from tech providers. Google made a big announcement about their agentic commerce platform, and specifically have a Google agent call stores on their behalf to check inventory, browse products with prompts, and actually check out using AI. So obviously Google is a huge player in the search space. So this is just being piloted with a couple partners, I believe Wayfair, Chewy, and one other, I can't remember off the top of my head. So, but I expect that we will see this be more broadly adopted in the weeks and the months ahead. So yeah, a lot going on.
Yeah. Speaking of a lot going on, last week's big announcement took both of us, I think, a little bit by surprise. Doug McMillon announcing he was leaving Walmart. And I won't say shocked, but you know, he's a young man and he's done so well. Their numbers are so good. Maybe he's leaving on a high note. Any early thoughts?
Yeah, I was. I think it's been clear that Walmart, as many good companies would do, was positioning potential successors. But yeah, the timing of it, I thought he was there for another year or two, but he will be apparently retiring at the end of January, so not too far away, to be replaced by John Furner, who I believe most people expected was really the heir apparent. And John has, I think he's 51, and he had previously ran Sam's Club US and currently runs the entire U.S. Walmart operation. So ton of experience, long history at Walmart. So, I mean, maybe we'll come back to this a little bit more before Doug completely steps down, but it's been an amazing tenure. The business has performed exceptionally well. We obviously talk about Walmart quite a bit for various things, but mostly how they've really become much more digitally enabled, how they've been able to put up really great numbers despite being a massive company, a lot of the innovations they're pushing ahead. So, and the stock, not that it's all about the stock performance, but Walmart stock has performed exceptionally well over the last, I'm going to say 7 or 8 years in particular. So yes, going out on a high note, incredibly well-respected leader, a ton to be proud of. And, you know, I'd imagine that Walmart will be in very capable hands, very strong team there with a lot of depth. So breadth and depth.
Yeah. Tremendous bench strength. All right. Well, that's a wrap on the news. Now let's get to our interview with Julie Bornstein. Before we do that, just for a couple of seconds, because it's a bit unusual, as I said off the top, for us to interview the leader of a company still in beta. We sometimes would like to see what happened versus
the way of revenues.
Yeah. So, Joe, give the people a little bit of insight as our thinking about why now talk to Julie.
Well, a couple of things I believe we've wanted to refocus on doing for the audience over the years is both to try to get things on folks' radar screen, whether it's a technology trend. So we're often talking to thought leaders or major technology companies that are doing something that we think is perhaps not being given enough attention by a lot of retailers, but also brands that might emerge, become much more prominent, like we've done with Vuori, like we've just did last week with Tecovas. You know, Julie is, as you mentioned at the top, and as people will hear in a second, a very experienced leader, has been involved with a lot of both legacy brands, early pioneer in e-commerce, raised $50 million for this venture. And despite it being product still being in beta, they are partnering with an incredible number of brands. So I think there's every reason to believe that this is a company that people will be talking a lot about in the next 12 months' time. But also they're doing something within the agentic commerce world that I think is super interesting. And whether or not you want to partner with Daydream or even take some of the lessons, it's something I think most of our listeners should be paying attention to. And she's a great person to talk about it.
All right. Let's hear that now.
Well, Julie, welcome to the Remarkable Retail Podcast. We're so excited to have you on and to tell us about your very, very exciting new venture. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, there's so many things we can talk about. I think we'll get into your background a little bit just here in a second. But you have been around the block and involved with so many interesting things. And one of the things we love to do on the podcast is to showcase brands, ventures, whatever, that might not be on everybody's radar screen, but definitely should. So that is part of the reason to have you on. But before we jump in about what you're working on, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, the work you do, and how you came to be working on Daydream?
Well, let's see. I've been obsessed with both shopping and probably search since I was a girl getting a magazine and looking for products in the mall. And when Amazon launched in 1996, I remember where I was sitting and thought, oh my gosh, e-commerce is going to change everything about the way we shop. And I've been working in the space ever since. I had the benefit of joining Nordstrom's.com business in the very early days and helping to build that 1.0 version. And then I've basically spent my career in the space, next at Urban Outfitters. And then I joined Sephora in the early days of them having built an e-commerce site and launched Beauty Insider, the loyalty program, and rebuilt e-commerce with an amazing team where we did a lot of fun things around social and mobile in the sort of height of those dates. And then I got to know Katrina Lake, the founder of Stitch Fix, joined her board, and then joined full-time to work at Stitch Fix for a few years, and then launched my own company called The Yes, which was a recommendation engine for fashion before Gen AI existed. We were acquired by Pinterest. And then a few years later, I started Daydream. And that's what we are working on now.
What a journey you've been on. And so you got enough out of the entrepreneurial spirit to do it all again. You've been AI, not just adjacent, but you've been following AI and you've been very close to AI. What was the inspiration? You could have done a lot of things with your background and expertise. What was the inspiration for Daydream? What's the gap in the market? What are you trying to do?
The truth is that it's very hard to find what you're looking for in a sea of overwhelming product selection. And so it's interesting, when we were starting Nordstrom.com, it was all a matter of convincing brands to sell online. Mm-hmm. And that problem has become kind of opposite today. And there are so many brands online and so many products online that it's completely overwhelming. And while Google, in theory, should be able to solve this problem, it really hasn't gone deep in the fashion vertical well enough to do it. And so we are very focused on helping people describe whatever it is they're looking for. And when ChatGPT launched, it sort of unearthed a whole new possibility of how to take search and combine it with a person's sort of regular language to figure out what it is that they needed or wanted, and then create the best fashion search engine that goes across the whole web. For now, we are working with only new products, so not secondhand, but we have over 10,000 brands on our platform. And the goal is, whether you want to start your search by showing a picture or asking for something specific or telling us about a situation you need to be dressed for, any of those are possibilities. And our goal is to both understand you, the shopper, and understand the catalog of millions and millions of products and help you find what's right for you.
Well, 10,000 brands, that feels like either a lot of cold calls or there's a machine and a business model behind that. Just take us through, you know, if you were operating a physical store, we'd ask you how many stores you had and all that kind of stuff. But take us through Daydream. How does it work and the business model? And I think I get the benefit, you know, the getting around the tyranny of choice, so to speak. And the benefit to the partners too, because if you got that many partners, clearly they're seeing something new about it.
Yep. So we have direct partnerships with about 350 retailers and brands. And so in that combination, many of the retailers carry thousands of brands. And so we have the full catalog of all of the sort of mid-tier to high-end retailers that are multi-branded, and then almost all of the major and many smaller brands directly. And we add multiple brands every week to our platform. And so our goal is to have direct relationships over time with every brand and retailer that has real brands. We are not focused on the sort of low end of the market, the brandless side where Temu and Amazon tend to play. But we are interested in any brand that stands for something and that we know sends email confirmations when you place an order, delivers on the service, and you're able to return the item. And so we wanted to create a catalog that's very clean and understandable to the user. And so through our partnerships with retailers and brands, we have a relationship where we get commission based on the sales that we drive, and that's the only thing they pay. So it's for them, it's kind of a no-brainer. And certainly I think all the brands and retailers are looking for ways to expand, finding new customers, and also learning about AI. And one of the things that we are starting to do is share data with the brands so that they can also learn what's happening in this new space.
Well, that's a super interesting element that the brands learn about AI through you. So what have you learned? Your product's still in beta. Any surprises? I'm sure there's been surprises, but challenges, opportunities. What have you learned on the journey so far?
Yeah, I have learned a lot. I have learned that starting a company for the second time is not necessarily easier, and that building on top of AI and these LLMs is actually quite complex. It's been super interesting because initially I think we all thought, oh, you build a wrapper around OpenAI and then you do the things you want on your site. But in fact, that is really not how it's ended up working. If you want to have a lot of accuracy and really understand the full range of customer questions and requests, you need to build a much deeper set of technology yourself. And so we've gone from this single model that called OpenAI to an ensemble of mini models that are experts at very specific parts of the fashion universe. And so we have a model that is for fabric type and a model that's for color and a model that's for neckline and for location. And if, as you can imagine, to be able to have both quick results, so low latency for the user, and also very accurate, it turns out it takes a pretty big technological effort to get there. And so I think the biggest surprise for me is just how hard it has been to build and the kind of talent that we needed in order to build it. We brought on a CTO at the beginning of this year, and she has brought on a very experienced machine learning engineering team. And we have sort of combined our fashion expertise with a team of in-house stylists with this amazing tech group and have been having a lot of fun building something that is, we are extremely passionate about. We have a lot more work to do. So being in beta has been helpful and interesting because we've had the chance to see the range of queries that people are coming in with, and it's all over the place. And it's that data that's really useful for continuing to train and improve the models.
We'll be right back after these messages. Promotional support for the Remarkable Retail podcast is provided by Crave Retail. What's retail's biggest blind spot? The fitting room. A shopper wants to buy, but can't get the help they need. That's why global brands partner with Crave Retail, the market leader in smart fitting rooms. Crave connects that moment to your business, giving shoppers a voice, associates real-time alerts, and teams the data to buy smarter. The result? Higher conversion, better decisions, a seamless experience. Learn how fast you can elevate your fitting rooms at craveretail.com. Promotional support for the show comes from Find Mine. In the time it takes to listen to this ad, your team could have leveled up their productivity by 90% and set up your brand for increased sales. FindMind's AI tools let you run operations on thousands of products right now. Get self-service AI to support product tagging for better success with AI agents, dynamic programmatic ads for Meta, visually similar product recs, complete the look styling, trend and campaign curations. FindMind's innovative enterprise platform currently generates breakthrough customer experiences for top brands like Lululemon and Ann Taylor. See what FindMind can do for you and join the waitlist at findmind.com/remarkable retail.
It's so impressive what you've been able to accomplish so far. I have a couple questions about how it is you were able to get, I think you said thousands, but certainly many hundreds of very well-known brands, Gucci, Nike, Nordstrom, et cetera, to work with you at such an early stage. Obviously, you have a ton of experience and an interesting business model, but I'm curious, how did you convince them to partner with you as a startup, number one? And number two, I think some people have been suggesting that your type of business model, it's not clear whether you're ultimately really a friend or perhaps competition with some of the intermediaries in the business. How did you convince them that you were a place to make a big bet relatively early?
It's a combination of having relationships already and being in this industry for a long time, being on their side of the table in the past. So I know what matters to them. And my co-founder, Lisa Yemner, and I have spent a lot of time listening and learning from the brands on what's important to them and what matters to them. And, you know, we had the advantage of having worked with many of these brands at our prior startup, The Yes. And we also understand how to show them the experience that we're going to give to the consumer in a way that even before the product was built, we built prototypes and we showed them exactly what the experience would be. And then, you know, I would say that we are very open. We take all the tech burden off of their plate, so it doesn't require tech lift from their end, which as a brand or as a retailer, we all had a list of 200 things we needed our small dev team to do, whether it was in-house or outsourced. And so knowing that there's limited bandwidth to do that, how do we make it as easy for them as possible? And how do we look at this as a learning experience for all of us? And so, you know, I would say we're a long ways from disintermediating any multi-branded retailer. I just think, you know, there is special assortments on these sites. There's a lot of customers who love them. I think once you get onto a site, you end up finding lots of other things you like. So we're more a lead gen for these retailers and brands. And, you know, I think because our model is we only charge you if you make a sale, it's an easier pill to swallow. So, you know, and I think at the end of the day, we love this space. I mean, I truly want this ecosystem to thrive. It would be very sad to me if there were only one retailer, you know, if Amazon had gotten hold of the fashion world and that was it, that would be a very sad place for all of us. And I love to shop in store as much as I do online. And, you know, all the things that we want to do to help the brands and retailers thrive are, you know, things that we think about for future product development.
Well, happy that it's not a sad place, but it's certainly a competitive place. I mean, you're solving an issue that has been around for a long time. Lots of people got very, very excited over these Gen AI models and saw potential. So how are you going to differentiate yourselves and build your moat, as the strategist would say, so that you've got something, you've built a tech team? That's certainly a big deal. Those folks aren't just sitting around having coffee. So you've done that. But, you know, that's certainly part of your moat, your people. But talk about that a little bit, because I think there's a lot of people generally heading in that same direction, and everybody's got some kind of handle on some kind of LLM or AI. How do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, first, I would say in the fashion tech space, I've observed that there are a lot of ideas, but none of them are really focused around search. And now that I've gone super deep into search, I realize why, just because it's a very hard problem to solve.
It's hard. Yeah.
And, you know, requires a real search expertise along with the ability to build out a sort of technology that leverages the LLMs. And so I think from a sort of startup standpoint, it would take anyone a couple of years to really make progress in this space with a lot of laser-like focus and a lot of capital behind them. But I think that as you think about like the Googles or the OpenAIs out there, you know, the way that we are so focused on this fashion vertical is hard to imagine any of the big players focusing on in this way. So I think while they will and continue, you know, Google has had Google Shopping forever, and they've now layered on a couple of fun elements like virtual try-on. But underlying it is their catalog that is very messy and very hard to get to what you're looking for. And so their ad units are pretty good, but they're, you know, once you go below the ad and you're searching for something, it's just filled with all sorts of, I don't know how else to say it, junk. You know, you get, no matter how many times I've actually bought things from Google, you know, from a click off of Google, they still show me Amazon and eBay and Etsy and things that are clearly not where I'm shopping. And then I think, you know, when I look at OpenAI, they're tackling so many things and they are truly proving to be an amazing force. But I do think that whoever, you know, wants to be able to do shopping really well needs to understand the differences between taste-based shopping and what I call spec-based shopping. So I think if you're looking at dryers or, you know, hair dryers or even beauty in some ways, you know, you still need to understand the domain really well, but there are specs around those products. Whereas a taste-based category like fashion and home are much more about understanding the nuance of style and helping put things that are in the realm close to the, you know, in front of the consumer, and then letting them figure out what variations on that they want until they find the right product. And so it's a really different both user flow and data training that you need to do to be able to tackle this. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, I don't see anyone doing quite what we're doing with our obsessive focus on this fashion vertical.
So I have I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this question, but back in my Neiman Marcus days, and this was very much the early days of AI for sure, but people would pitch us on various sort of outfitting technology or trend predicting kind of technology. And it seemed like part of the issue there was trying to get the right blend between science, you know, sort of predicting what worked in the past versus really being able to have that kind of art part of what really worked. So I guess my question is it a fundamental challenge to use Gen AI, agentic AI, to accomplish some of these tasks where you've got to really bring in the art part of it as well as the science? Or is that something that really, you know, we're getting to an era of artificial intelligence that has a lot more ability to make those interesting connections and kind of see the future as opposed to just interpret it and generate the next kind of logical thing that people should want? Does that question make any sense?
No, it's a great question. I mean, I think today my belief is you need the combination of human and machine to be able to do this really well. And we sort of have to do that in many ways. So if we're trying to understand a trend and make sure that when someone asks about it, we understand the context of it, especially if it's a new trend, because sometimes it hasn't even made its way through the LLMs yet. We do a number of things to understand that. We go out to the web and we understand where the trend is out there and pull information. And then we also do our own training with our team of stylists in-house, where we will build basically training boards that show you a trend with products that are associated with that trend. And so we use humans for both training models. We use humans for spot checking results. And we have a set of kind of golden queries that we're constantly measuring results on. And we measure them in three different ways. We measure them based on sort of an LLM telling us if we've actually factually met that, you know, the goal of the prompt. We measure them by seeing consumer engagement and do they find things that they like from that search query. And then we also do our own spot checking to see what, you know, the experience was like for the user, and are we showing the right sets of products? And it gets even more complicated because we're doing personalization as well. And so, you know, what you see and what I see with the same query could be very different. What I would say is, you know, to your point, it's hard to get a taste-based, you know, sort of search where you can anticipate what someone is going to like perfect. And so rather than try and get it perfect on the first go round, our whole system is built for refinement in a natural way. So you can have a conversation with the agent and say, you know, I'm looking for something that's a little bit shorter, or I want stuff that's more colorful, or you can go to a specific product and you can say, I like this, but it's too low cut, or I want it in, you know, navy blue, whatever it is that you are looking for. So we sort of understand the fact that finding the perfect product is sort of a journey. And we've built tools to get you there. And we've also used humans to be both training and checking on that experience. I think that ultimately our goal is to be, you know, a personal stylist in your pocket. But today we are sort of starting with search because that's where we need to build the understanding of both the catalog, so all the products that we're getting from all these amazing brands and retailers, and sort of the user and the context of the user's request. And so pulling together those three sets of information give us a lot of good starting signal for search. But over time, being able to predict what you might need and what you might want becomes easier once we have all of this data in one place.
Sure. No, so it's so interesting. I guess this is where the fact that it is a very complicated business is both a challenge, but it's your opportunity if you can get ahead of everybody on this and obviously leverage the talent and experience that you and your team have had. Just want to make a quick pivot. I'm curious, you've had this great mix of working for some very large, iconic, established, or at least more established brands, but also all this great startup experience. I guess for, you know, we have an audience that is both working at large brands as well as those that are entrepreneurs and everybody in and around the retail ecosystem. So I'm curious, what have been some of the biggest leadership differences in working in those different spaces, and how has that positioned you to take this next journey?
It's such an interesting question because it's actually feels very different as a leader running division within a big company versus running your own startup. And I would say a couple of things. The first is, I mean, I loved my work at Nordstrom, at Sephora, at Urban Outfitters. It was amazing. I had great teams, great bosses, and, you know, the benefit of a brand that was already beloved. And so, especially at Sephora, when I think about it, I was there during such a high time of technology change. So mobile became a thing, social became a thing, and those really unlocked so many new experiences. And so we had this audience that was automatically there, and we could try all sorts of things and, you know right away if something was going to work or not. And that was such an advantage. I think, you know, working at a bigger company, you have the advantage of people are really brand loyal. And so, you know, when I think about all of those brands, people felt who came and worked for us felt so strongly about the brand. And it was so much fun to be a part of Sephora, for example. And it's, you know, so beloved by so many people. And you feel like you're a part of a bigger movement. And so I think that while I was always in a bit of a, I guess, entrepreneurial role in each of the bigger companies, because we were building out the e-commerce, the digital divisions within them. And I spent a lot of time kind of pitching to the other departments in the company and to our holding companies why this mattered. You know, we had this sort of installed base of users and a team that was very bought in to the overall mission. And so it was, you know, both really fun to be doing it on behalf of a brand that we all love. And also exciting to be building new things for an established brand. I would say when it's a startup, it's totally different because you have to convince everyone.
Right. Who's missionary joining, work, so to speak.
That, you know, that you're going to be building something that's amazing. You definitely, your employee base is definitely has a higher tolerance for risk without a doubt. And the pace of the work is quite different. So what's interesting is I went from retailers to working for a year at Pinterest and then starting Daydream. And, you know, having been at retailers, retailers, as you guys know, are very lean. And so I always felt in all of, you know, whether it was Nordstrom or Sephora, every person, you know, had a pretty big scope and we were running tightly and we were moving fast and you're looking at your sales every day and it's a very responsive and, you know, the margin structure requires you to be so. It was super interesting being for a little while in big tech because it's a very different work environment and there are a lot more people doing much more narrow jobs. And, you know, I found that the pace of work was actually much slower than retail and slower than startup. And so what's interesting is now that I'm back to the startup world, you have to find people who like to move fast and they're sort of, you know, very action oriented, like to test, like to learn quickly. And, you know, also I feel like every day I need to kind of resell the vision and remind everyone why they're here and keep them excited about something that is completely unknown, you know? And so I think I've always felt a lot of gratitude for my teams. I've loved my teams and had amazing people in all of these companies, but you know, the team that will follow you to a startup is a really unique kind of relationship. And I think that for me, the reason I ended up moving to a startup is because when I thought about my future, I thought I want to run a big company, but it needs to be a company that I really believe is going to be the future and not the past. And I kind of want to build that company. And so the 0 to 1 is painful because there's so much ambiguity. And, you know, building something from total scratch is much harder than it is actually like improving a product. And so, you know, it has its pros and its cons, but definitely feels different.
Well, speaking of the future, and it kind of might be a strange question to ask an organization still in beta, but what's next for you guys? What are you most excited about? I guess getting out of beta is probably a default statement. It's around the corner. What's next?
This year has been a sort of sole focus on the search experience with the agent and personalization. And we've really not focused on customer acquisition or growth yet. We've really focused on getting that core engine working well. And so next year for us is, well, in parallel, because we will constantly be working to improve search personalization. Those are never ending efforts. You know, we'll be at the point where we'll come out of beta next year and we will start to play around with a number of different ideas to bring customers in and to expand the use cases. So some of the things that we're thinking about are some really interesting things around outfitting, some interesting things about social. So being able to get your friends and family's feedback on the products that you like, being able to make suggestions easily, being able to follow people whose style you admire, and some of those things. And then, you know, we're going to start to think about secondhand at some point. And yeah, I think that those are a couple of the things that are most top of mind. We're also doing some tests with Apple. We're about to launch an app, which is launching any day now, which we're excited about. And so there are some cool features that are part of iOS 26 that we're excited to be a part of. And then we're also doing a test with Instagram. So, you know, we have a lot of coals in the fire.
Yeah. Well, what an exciting journey you've been on. You live at this, so it's such a fascinating intersection of retail and technology, social media, now AI. So what a treat we had having you on the podcast. So thanks so much for being here on the Remarkable Retail Podcast with Steve and I on behalf of us both. And we wish you much, much, much continued success. We'll be watching and hopefully that moat will keep you safe and profitable and continue to do exciting things. So thanks again for joining us on the pod.
Thanks so much, you guys. It was always fun to talk to you.
All right, we are back. Great interview with Julie, and such a treat to talk to someone who's just making such important strides in an area that's super, super interesting to us. All right, let's give us something to talk about. You and I had the same one.
Oh, really? Yeah,
but I have a fun footnote for it. So go. Let's talk about skims.
You would think we plan this, but we don't always. Some of it's planned. Some of it's planned, but yeah, Skims, Kim Kardashian's brand, they raised $225 million last week, and they are now at a $5 billion valuation. So for a pretty small brand, really in the scheme of things, that's pretty hefty valuation. That's a pretty nice amount of money to raise. We understand that the funds are going to be going to fuel retail expansion, including international growth. Right now, they have 18 stores, but are starting to open them at a pretty good pace. That's U.S. only, though they do have two franchises in Mexico. So I think we would expect to see quite a few store openings. My guess that Skims will be opening here in London pretty soon. Seems like all the major brands, whether they're coming from the U.S. or wherever they might be coming from, South Korea, are here. There have been some rumors that they are looking to go public in the not too distant future. So some speculation that this is a bridge to get them to that IPO and be able to really drive their revenues much faster. Of course, when you talk about these celebrity-driven brands, you've got the brand like Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, which was very, very big for a hot minute, maybe not so much anymore. So there's always benefits and risks to a celebrity-led brand. But you know, here's an example of how social media, TikTok, et cetera, has fueled a product line above and beyond just her. You know, obviously, Kim Kardashian and the Kardashians have been part of the cultural zeitgeist for quite a while now. So it'll be really interesting to see where they can go with this. I have to say, I don't totally understand what is so special about this brand. It seems fairly anodyne in a lot of respects. and whether they can really justify and grow from that $5 billion valuation, I guess time will tell.
Well, here's a fun factoid, just building on that. I know Kim Kardashian. I spent a day with her launching a product here in at the Shopping Channel. So this is many years ago. My takeaway is, never count her out in terms of anything. She's such a hardworking. I mean, she was leaving Toronto to go do a mall intercept at El Segundo in California. Like, she works very, very hard, very entrepreneurial, and knows exactly how to, you know, position things, and marketing is just fantastic. I mean, it just comes to her. Yeah. So her and the team. So, you know, for someone who is famous for being famous, if you, so to speak, I mean, it's just been an incredible rise of a brand that, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have seen it. I do have one, salute, and I had this interview this week with Michael Medline, who is now the former CEO of Sobeys Empire. Michael was actually the former CEO also of Canadian Tire. We had his successor, Greg Hicks, on. So salute to Michael. It's a great case study, and you'll find my interview with him online, of a bold acquisition, poorly integrated, and then he brought Michael in, and it took him nine years, though, to completely turn it around and make Sobeys and Empire Group a very, very productive company. He's going off to run the Woodbridge Group, so he's going to be the CEO of the holding company that owns Thomson Reuters and the Globe and Mail newspaper. So he's a fellow media baron like us. So
that's right. I was going to say, I definitely put us in the same tier.
All right, what's on your radar screen for something coming up?
You know, this is one, I guess, both easy and hard to give full service to, because at one level it's pretty obvious, but I'm really trying to pay attention to whether the mood, you know, this is mostly about the U.S., the mood and perhaps some policies might be about to shift in a major way. As we talked about earlier, the shutdown and the ripple effects create a lot of uncertainty. We've seen quite a lot of stock market volatility the past week. I think a lot of that has to do with AI, not so much about what's going on with the macroeconomic policy. Every study I see shows consumer confidence continuing to decline. It's particularly terrible among young folks. This issue of affordability, which, by the way, Trump made it sound like he made up the word affordability in recent comments. I always love that, just like groceries. People are using the word groceries now. Like, what is that? I'm like, groceries? Like, I don't know.
For someone who's probably never shopped for groceries in his entire life.
But, you know, that's been a big part of the conversation around the shutdown, but also just more broadly as inflation starts to be a bigger deal. Study that I was looking at last week said that 62% of Americans say the cost of everyday items is up in the last month. And one of the things I just want to mention really briefly about inflation, I saw an economist talking about this. We haven't seen in the data all that much inflation in total. We've seen pieces of it. But one of the things this economist was saying is there's the perception and then there's the reality of inflation. And he said one of the things is there's a frequency bias with inflation. You know, if you think about what you paid for a big screen TV or a mattress 7, 8, 9 years ago, you probably don't remember, or even a pair of jeans, because you might get a different color, different size, different brand or whatever. But you're buying groceries frequently. You're shopping for gas frequently. So even if those items are a relatively small percentage of your total spending, because you're familiar with them, you really notice, or, you know, you go to Chipotle or Starbucks, you know, you really notice those things because of the frequency. And so it may create a perception that's not lined up with reality, but it may cause consumers to pull back, even if in reality it's not necessarily hitting them as hard. Well, anyway, from a policy standpoint, just really quickly, the taco trade is back. It looks like the Trump administration is getting more worried about the president's, I think he's got about a 27% approval rating on managing the economy. There's some talk, or not talk, I guess there's an agreement to start pulling back tariffs on things like bananas and some other items from a few South American countries. In the scheme of things, this is really small to the total, but it might be suggesting that, I mean, who could have predicted that tariffs would increase prices? Very, very hard to believe. So anyway, we'll see if these carve-outs and exemptions start to get more significant. Also, just you keep seeing a lot of big company layoffs. The announced layoffs in the United States reached the highest level in 20 years last month. 55% of employees say they're worried about losing their job. So, you know, it's hard to look at all of this as well as just kind of the machinations around the government and the Epstein files and all this other, you know, kind of stuff, just not having a somewhat depressive effect on the economy. But as we talked about near the top of the show, it's not showing up in a significant way in the numbers yet.
Well, from my perspective, I want to stick with the grocery aisle. Some interesting data from Circana, the big food industry analyst. The GLP-1 holiday. So we talk about the AI holiday. It's really a GLP-1 holiday. And some fascinating stuff. 23% of the U.S. households are now using GLP-1s. A shocking number. Many, you know, some for medical reasons, many for weight loss. It's increased 16%. Year over year, 2.9 million users. And the impact on the food services was not exactly as predicted. So in some ways, they're not consumers on GLP-1s are not necessarily downshifting their purchasing, but they're changing it dramatically. So you now have like a big run on proteins, right? You see protein on everything because you need the protein. You see cottage cheese is having a big moment, big TikTok moment. You see, and interestingly, the in the takeout sector, the QSR is actually going up, not down, because people are looking for protein smoothies. So they're actually going out. They may not be shopping at a McDonald's for a burger, but they're going and looking for a protein smoothie. So it's fascinating stuff. And really, I was thinking of it as the first GLP-1 holiday of, you know, it's hitting just, and it's not even in pill form yet. So I expect the story will just keep giving and giving and giving. So that's what I'm kind of keeping my eye on for the next couple of weeks. For now, let's leave it there.
Thanks for tuning in. To help more retail leaders discover the industry's leading podcast, please drop us that 5-star rating and review on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you enjoy your pods. And for more on my strategic advisory services, keynote speaking, best-selling books, and even more retail industry insights, go to stephenpdennis.com.
If you are a brand or service provider looking to take your influence to the next level, reach out to us for sponsorship, advertising, or event partnerships. And if you want to learn more about my own keynote speaking and advisory practice, reach out to me via LinkedIn.